Okay, guys, so today we are talking about chapter 3 in this podcast, which is Ancient Egypt. So if you guys want to pull up your D2L account and download your chapter 3 PowerPoint to follow along, I'll be referring to various slides throughout the podcast. So let's get started. So the first thing we need to talk about in Egypt is their kind of religious system, their religious beliefs, because their entire culture and society is built around this system. For the Egyptians, death is important. Life was meant to prepare for the afterlife. So everything they did in their living life was thought to benefit them in the afterlife. We know that the Egyptians erect huge monuments to their kings, the pyramids, which we will talk about a little bit later. And it's important to remember that it's not just royals that are entitled to an afterlife. Everybody is entitled to some sort of afterlife. Now, a lower level priest may not have the same afterlife as the pharaoh, but everyone gets an afterlife. There's a word highlighted in blue in our first slide, and it says Ka. Now, the Ka is a life force, or you can think of it as like a soul or a spirit. And for the Egyptians, they believed that your Ka would continue to inhabit the corpse after an individual died. And so a lot of times we'll see sculptures of pharaohs or whoever it may be buried in a certain tomb, or if, be it a pyramid or an underground chamber, there will be a sculpture of that person so that the Ka has something to move into as the body, you know, decomposes over time, and the sculpture will last forever for the Ka to live in. The tombs that the Egyptians built were to allow for the Ka to have a next life. So the Egyptians are going to bury their dead with everything they would need. Everything they need in this life, you'll see in their tombs. Food, clothing, jewelry, furniture, servants. It was considered a great honor to be buried with the pharaoh, to serve him in the afterlife. I don't know that I could do that, but that is something that was very common in the Egyptian culture. So we're going to move on to the next slide. Let's talk about some of the things that are buried that we've found with the dead in their tombs. We see stone and metal objects. We even find perishable items, which means things that would normally decompose or lose quality over time, such as papyrus. Now, papyrus is a plant in Egypt. It's a very fibrous plant. Think of it like celery. And they would use it to make paper. And this would roll up. And so we have things called papyrus scrolls, which would be paper made out of this plant that rolls into a scroll. Now, we're talking about tombs, be it a pyramid or an underground chamber. And so therefore, these items survive for 3,000 years, because they're not exposed to the elements. They are kept dry. So this image you have on your first slide is called Cuneiform Scroll, and it's actually a collection of spells and prayers, and it was meant to help secure a happy afterlife. Some of these we found are over 70 feet in length, which is pretty insane. So it's called The Judgment of Cuneiform. It's from the Book of the Dead. And I'm just going to kind of walk you guys through some of the imagery in this scroll. So if you look for the Jekyll-headed figure, he's going to be to the far left, and he's leading Cuneiform, our main character. This is Anubis. He's the Jekyll-headed god, and he is the god of embalming. And he's leading Cuneiform into what we would call the Hall of Judgment, where you can assume someone's going to be judged, right? The god then... Next, you can see Anubis squatting down, and here he's adjusting the scales. So the Egyptians believed that when you passed into the next life, your heart would be weighed on a scale with a feather. Now, if your heart was heavier than the feather, then you had led a poor life. You had not been a good person, and your afterlife would reflect that. So your goal was to have your heart be lighter than the feather, which means that you carried good deeds with you and no heavy darkness. So that's what's happening in the center. Now, if you look, there is a hieroglyph of a feather, and I'm trying to find it because I'm looking at this very closely. going to zoom in so I can actually tell you guys where to find it. This is what I'm looking for here is the hieroglyph for the goddess Ma'at. That's M-A-A-T. And that's the feather that you see weighing. So Ma'at, her symbol is this feather that's weighing. It's a hieroglyph. So if you ever see a feather, you know that it's symbolizing that specific god. And symbol of truth. Okay, this is very important. You'll see this in a lot of Egyptian hieroglyphs, especially in tombs. Now, next to Anubis and the scale, you see a crocodile, hippopotamus, lion kind of monster. And this is Ammit, A-M-M-I-T. And he is waiting. He is the devourer of the sinful. So he waits for the scale. And if the scale weighs the heart as heavy, meaning that this is a sinful person, Ammit gets to devour the sinful. Talk about, you know, horrifying. The ibis-headed god, Thoth, is seen recording the proceedings. So the ibis is the blue bird, and he has a very long, skinny beak, and he's recording, so he's documenting what happens. You can tell that the Egyptians like to document because this entire rendering is full of documentation that explains to us what is happening in hieroglyphics. You can even see on the top all the seated gods. Those are more gods from the Egyptian pantheon, which is their like collection of gods, and they're witnessing. Now, Hunneber is shown kneeling before them. If you look at the very top, right in front of them. So you can see Hunneber actually three times. He's in the beginning, being led by Anubis. At the top, he's kneeling before all the gods, and then we're going to move to the third portrayal of Hunneber, which is where he is being led by Horus, which is the falcon-headed god right in front of him, into meet Osiris. And Osiris is like this leader of the gods. He has a green face. He's very recognizable. And his sister, Isis, and his other sister, Nephthys, stand behind him. They are kind of the top dogs in the god pantheon for the Egyptians. So Hunneber's heart is weighed. He is found to be lighter than the feather, and so therefore he is worthy, and he is taken to meet with Osiris. This concept of the afterlife on the process exists for over 7,000 years in Egypt, which is a very long time to have the same kind of belief, specific belief. So this hieroglyph ends well for Hunneber. He is guided into a nice afterlife. So let's move on to our next slide where we're going to talk about Egypt and Egyptology. So I call this the backbone of Egypt, the Nile River. So the Nile River goes north and south through Egypt. Now take a look at the map because this is a little confusing. You'll notice the Mediterranean Sea is at the north, and that is Lower Egypt. And then if you go south, that's Upper Egypt. This seems counterintuitive to us because we would think upper would be further north. Not in this case. It actually has to do with the river itself. The Nile originates in Africa, in the lower portion of Africa, because of the elevation it drains into the Mediterranean Sea. So Upper Egypt is where the Nile starts, and Lower Egypt is where it flows downriver into the Mediterranean Sea. Some areas along the Nile River do not receive a drop of rain for a decade. That is why the Nile is so important, because it allows the ground around the river to be fertile. A lot of times the river will flood upriver in Upper Egypt, and then that causes flooding throughout Egypt as the water flows down. So what happens is as the water rises, your ground is covered in water that normally isn't, and it is fertilized by that water and the sediment, and it gives us this rich soil in Egypt, and then we are able to plant and grow in that soil. If you look at our next slide, we're going to talk a little bit about Egyptian history, because it's important to understand what we really know. So in the 1700s, there's this period of enlightenment, which means everyone wants to be enlightened. And so there's a lot of research going on and trying to piece together Egyptian history. So the three main sources for Egyptian history are A, the Old Testament in the Bible. B, a Greek historian, Herodotus, who is writing in the 5th century BCE. And then in the 3rd century BCE, we have a history of Egypt that's written by an Egyptian priest, and he writes this in Greek. Now, the priest who wrote this Egyptian history did not have exact dates, and therefore, we really don't know the exact dates of dynasties. So when I'm talking about different dynasties or different rulers, we know the general order, but the dates themselves of that ruler's rule are a little rough. So we piece together what we can with what we have. The modern discipline, this modern Egyptology, comes around in the 1700s, and it begins with this Nile River that's so important, this backbone of Egypt and the exploration of the Nile. In fact, Napoleon, remember Napoleon from France? Yeah, Napoleon comes down and he leads a military expedition, and he brings scholars and artists and linguists who know the language, and antiquarians, so people who are experts on antiques. And they go through the Nile looking for artifacts. And this is where we find the Rosetta Stone. The Rosetta Stone is important because it allows us to crack the code for the hieroglyphics. The Rosetta Stone has one inscription, but it's repeated 3 times, once in Greek, once in hieroglyphs, and one in Demotic, which is elite Egyptian language. So because we could read Greek, we were able to decipher the hieroglyphs. And this is why we can now read. And we know what happens to Hunifer in his inscriptions. All right, so let's move into Egypt itself. So our first slide on the dynasties is slide 7. And this is going to be pre-dynastic, which means before there were dynasties, which we know dynasties are like the passing on, right? A ruler who passes his ruling right on. So this is going to be before those and then the very early dynasties. So prehistoric beginnings of Egypt predate writing. We know that that means prehistory means there is no writing. So we find tombs that have paintings, pottery, and other significant artifacts that tell us even before there were writing, there was writing in this culture, they were very sophisticated. We're talking 3500 BCE. It's the start of the pre-dynastic period. So let's take a look on slide 8 of a work of art from the pre-dynastic period. This is a upper grassland for hunting and a lower rich soil of the Nile. So this mural from a tomb actually shows us both upper and lower Egypt. So it tells us that they were aware of the areas around the Nile in 3500 BCE. So if you can pick out where the hunting is, and if you can pick out where the rich soil of the Nile and the agriculture is, this dates to about 3500 BCE, so about 5,000 years old. Now, our next work of art is very important, and you will probably see this on a quiz, on a test at some point, because it is pretty important to understanding early Egypt. This is called the Palette of King Narmer, and it shows the unification, we think, let me clarify, we think this shows the unification of Upper and Lower Egypt, which means that they were separate, and then something caused them to unite. And that's when the pre-dynastic period ends, whenever Upper and Lower Egypt become united and they become a dynasty. One of the this is one of the earliest historical artworks we have, and it was found in the same location as the mural we just looked at. We thought that it was first showing us the founding of Egypt's dynasties, but now we think it's just specific to the unification of Upper and Lower Egypt. And historians believe it shows the creation of the kingdom of the two lands, the upper and the lower. A palette, let's back up a little bit. If you look on your slide, there's a 1 foot mark on the side. So you can see that it's about 2 feet. So 24 inches maybe. And a palette would have been used to mix eye makeup. we know that the Egyptians wore eye makeup to protect their eyes from the glare and the irritation of the sun. And so they would have mixed it on this kind of like a compact and then applied it. So on the top, you can see there are two heads of cows with female faces. And then there is the goddess Hathor, who is the divine mother of all Egyptians, all Egyptian gods. And then between the two is the hieroglyph for Narmer's name. So we've got the two heads of the cows, and then we have Narmer's name in the middle. And then we have a chisel. Do you see a chisel? So if you zoom in, this is actually hard to see on this slide, but if you can zoom in, you can see that the slide shows you that the inscription for Narmer's name is made up of a catfish and a chisel. A catfish meant an AR and a chisel meant MER. So when you put a catfish and a chisel together in hieroglyphics, you get Narmer. And that means that this has writing, which makes it historic. So if you go to the next slide, you can actually see the front and the back of the palette. So like I said, on the front, we have the two heads of the cows. And then on the back, we have the king. You're going to have to zoom in. Do you guys remember the word register or band, which means levels? So we have our two cows at the top on the back side. And on the register right below that, we have the king, who is very large, that hierarchical scale. He's the most important, so he's the largest. And then you see like a procession of soldiers in front of him, and they are much smaller. If you look at the hat the king is wearing, it has two parts to it. It has a front part that curls out, and it has a back part that sticks out behind. So those are both crowns of Egypt. So one of those would have been worn by the ruler of Lower Egypt, and one would have been worn by the ruler of Upper Egypt. And so the fact that Narmer is shown wearing both together means that's why we think this is a unification of the two. You can see that Narmer is slaying enemies, because on that same register, that top register, you see bodies with their heads actually laying between their feet. If you zoom in, you'll be able to see that. We have a falcon. The falcon symbolizes Horus. So Horus is this, you know, the son of Osiris and is a very important god. And so Narmer is aligning himself with that god by including an image of the falcon. Now, do you guys see the two crazy circular necks? Okay, those are some type of feline. And where they make that kind of circular form, which you can see by their necks, it's indented, that's where the makeup would have gone. So the makeup would have been placed there, and then you could have used this to create and mix. One more thing I want to point out is that composite view, C-O-M-P-O-S-I-T-E. And that means that their chests are facing forward, but their feet and their heads are facing profile. Remember, they're trying to show you depth, but they haven't quite figured it out yet. Composite view. All right, let's move on. Let's talk a little architecture. So in this early period in Egypt, we don't have pyramids. We have mastabas. And so this is an image of mastaba in the floor plan. And so they're mud brick rectangular burial chambers. Usually for single people, a single body would be buried in each mastaba. But eventually they become much larger and they put whole families in them. If you go to the next slide, you can see what a mastaba looked like, how it survives today. And then we get our first type of pyramid. So we're on slide 13. Imhotep was one of the most renowned builders in Egyptian history. He's very famous. He's the first recorded name of an artist anywhere in the world. He was a high priest to a sun god, and actually he becomes deified, or he's made a god himself after he dies. This is a step pyramid. You can tell why it's called step pyramid. It's got levels from Saqqara. Saqqara is an ancient city of the dead. We call this a necropolis. Polis means city, and necro means dead, so city of the dead. This is one of the oldest stone structures in Egypt, and it is a tomb, not a temple platform. That was the ziggurat we looked at last time, where it had the levels, and then they would have built a temple on top. This is different. A step pyramid is a tomb. This was the king Djoser. It was his pyramid. I have a rendering on slide 15 where it shows you the entire complex as it would have been in the time. It had 34-foot tall walls. It's almost a 3-story high wall around the entire complex. It was about 37 acres. Most people's houses in Houston are not even on like a fourth of an acre, if that helps. So maybe like an entire housing addition. And they were trying to keep people out of the burial chambers. In fact, they would even put dummy buildings in the complex. So buildings that looked like they held things but had nothing in them, trying to trick grave robbers. And then we get into the Old Kingdom. This was the golden age of Egyptian art and architecture. That means that it is what we know today. It's the most successful and the thing that has resided the longest. So what Old Kingdom is known for is going to be the Pyramids of Giza. And that's one of the 7 ancient wonders of the world, the surviving 7 ancient wonders of the world. Now, there is an old, a middle, and a new kingdom, but starting now, we're going to be in the Old Kingdom. So the pyramids are meant to be a symbol of the sun. So the rays of the god kings ascended to the heavens when they died. And what that means is that you would be directed towards the sun through the tip of the pyramid. So your Ka, if you're a king, gets to ascend and become a god in the heavens. Whereas, you know, maybe if you're an everyday priest, your Ka just moves to that sculpture that looks like you and inhabits it. So the pyramids are pointed at the sky for a reason, to direct the god kings. So let's talk about the complex itself. So if you will move to slide 18, there's a rendering of the complex itself. You'll notice that the 3 pyramids are completely different in size and in general. Our first complex is the far left. It's labeled number 1, and that was for Menkaure. Okay, so that's Menkaure. And the second is for Khafre. And the third is for Khufu. So the smallest you can assume was built first. And then the next guy thought, ooh, I'm going to build mine a little bit bigger. And I'm going to stick a very famous sculpture in front of it, the Sphinx. So if you look, the Sphinx is actually the front of the second, the middle pyramid, and it serves as a guardian for the pyramid. And then finally, Khufu comes in and decides to blow them all away with the biggest pyramid of all. You can see that Khufu's, the furthest to the right, the largest, has a complex of smaller mastabas, small flat tombs that we just looked at, which would have held probably his wives and his families. They would not have been buried with him. Their 4 sides on each of these pyramids match the cardinal points, north, south, east, and west. They're almost like palaces for the afterlife. They're very over the top. It took about 75 years from start to finish these 3 with 3 different pharaohs. Now, something to note is that not every ruler in ancient Egypt is a pharaoh. A pharaoh means son, like a god king. Pharaoh means god king. And so these rulers that claim to be pharaohs are claiming to be basically inhabitant, like the gods inhabiting the earth. Not everyone claims that. So we have kings who don't claim that, and then we have pharaohs who claim to be gods on earth. So these pyramids, if you look on slide 19, had so many chambers that were meant to fake out thieves, these tomb raiders. So if you look on this plan, you'll see that there would have been a fake false tomb chamber. It's labeled as 7, and there's a direct path from the entrance to that. And that's not where the king would have been buried. The pharaoh would have been buried. The pharaoh would have been actually buried in 5, in the middle, and then they would have closed up the pathway there so that the thieves would not have been able to get in. And then you can actually see that there have been some thief tunnels dug in, but they couldn't necessarily get, you know, get to it very easily. They had to try a few times. Now let's talk on slide 20 about the Great Sphinx. The Sphinx is 65 feet high. That's almost a six-story building. And it has the head of King Khafre on it. Now, actually, this is being debated right now. There's a current historian, art historian, who's trying to prove that it's not necessarily Khafre. But for now, we're going to assume it's Khafre's tomb. It matches images of Khafre. So we're going to assume that it is Khafre. It has the body of a lion, and it is what we would call colossal, meaning extremely large. It originally had a beard and headdress with a snake, but you can imagine what the erosion is like in ancient Egypt with all that sand over time. All right, so let's move on to slide 21. This is a sculpture, like I was talking about earlier, that would house the ka, or the soul after death. This is for Khafre. So remember, Khafre is a pharaoh, so his ka would eventually shoot through the top of the pyramid right to the sun and ascend to the heavens. But there is a sculpture in here for his ka as well. It's preserved because it's made out of a really hard stone called diorite that actually exists 400 miles downriver from this site of the pyramids, which is pretty impressive to move hard stone 400 miles in 2500 BCE, no less. So this was found near the Great Sphinx. Okay, so let's move on to 22. On slide 22, we have a king, Menkaure, and his wife, and they are standing next to each other. This is a sculpture that is in the round, which means that you can walk around it. It's not a relief sculpture that's part of a wall. But if you notice, they're actually attached to a pillar in between the two of them because they can't. The Egyptians haven't quite figured out how to make a sculpture stand on its own without falling or breaking from the weight. So they have this pillar that they're attached to for support. This was in Menkaure's pyramid. Notice their pose. It's very rigid. It's very stoic, which means still. They don't have personality or expressions. His hands are straight down. And you can tell that she's his wife because she places her arm on his bicep, and then around his waist. But there's no sense of emotion or affection. And the reason for that is the Egyptians are trying to make their sculptures look timeless. They're all encompassing, and they do not change. They want to look strong forever because that ka could inhabit them. Now, that was an image of a king and a queen. Now, let's look at a more everyday kind of sculpture, someone who is less high in the social hierarchy. So this is a scribe, which is someone who takes notes and writes. If you notice, he has a personality. I mean, not a great, huge personality, but he's smiling slightly. He's sitting. He's not on a throne. He sits on the ground. He's not an exalted figure. He's an everyday person. He's not muscular. He has a realistic kind of sagging skin. There's a texture to his body that is not hard and stiff like stone. Now, this is not a true portrait. A portrait means that you actually made it of a specific person. So if you take a selfie, that's a portrait. But if you invent a person and draw them, it's not a portrait because they don't exist in real life. You didn't copy it from a real person. So this is what an everyday person, how they would be depicted. Now, just a few notes can be found on slide 24 about the Middle Kingdom. Basically, there's a civil war, and then Egypt reunites and is reestablished under a central rule. But the major innovation of this period, artistically, is the inclusion of royal portraits, like the one you see to your right. So this would have been a portrait of a ruler, so it's a real person. And it's very different from that Old Kingdom style. You get more realism. There's a sense of an actual person. You notice his eyes have a little bit of a bag underneath them, and his lids are a little heavy. Not an idealized portrait like Menkaure and his wife, where they look very perfect. I did want to show you on slide 25 an example of a tomb from the Middle Kingdom. We move from pyramids into just a tomb cut into a wall, and then they would paint inside the tomb and decorate the inside of the tomb. But we're not having independent mastabas, and we're not having pyramids anymore. These are built into cliffs. You can assume that's probably due to financial reasons, right? And pyramids need a lot of manpower and a lot of money to build. All right, let's talk New Kingdom. So during the New Kingdom, Egypt actually pushes its borders out, and you can see on this map that they go up into Syria and all the way up to almost the Tigris and the Euphrates. This is the most glorious period in Egyptian history, the most wealthy. Thebes is the capital at this point, and the kings are called pharaohs. So remember I told you that kings and pharaohs are different. Pharaohs are the god kings, and this is the period of the pharaohs. So here is an example of a temple built on slide 27, and it was actually built by Hatshepsut. Hatshepsut was a female pharaoh. This is a big deal. She is known as a very popular pharaoh, too. She did very well for herself as a female pharaoh. I do want you to know that these are called pylon temples, which just means that they have like a big gateway that you would walk up. You can see the spectacular stairway, and they have columns that line them. They're very elaborate and completely different from anything we've seen before. Here's the temple for Hatshepsut, a better picture, on slide 28. And on slide 29, if you're curious about the floor plan, I've included that as well. But we're going to keep moving and speed up a little bit because I don't want to make you listen to me forever. So on slide 30, we're going to look at an example of painting. This is from a tomb of a ruler named Nebamun. So Nebamun shows himself hunting waterfowl, birds that live near the water. And you can see that his child is seated underneath him on this boat, and his wife stands behind him. Something I would like to stress to you is that the Egyptians never show you anything from their current life. Everything they show you is of the afterlife. So here we see Nebamun, and he is hopefully going to be hunting with his wife and his child in his afterlife. You can see the plants on the far left. That's papyrus that we talked about earlier. Also, notice the difference in skin tone. Do you see how Nebamun has a more orange tone and his daughter and wife have a more brown tone? That is because the Egyptians use color to differentiate male and female. So you can usually tell who a male is and who a female is by the color that the Egyptians have painted them. Okay, so we're going to move on slide 31 to probably one of the more interesting rulers from the New Kingdom. And his name is Akhenaten. So Akhenaten is famous because he decides in the 1350s BCE to get rid of the pantheon or the mini gods of Egypt and replace all these gods with one god. This is a big deal because for thousands of years it's been a certain way, and now this ruler has decided, nope, we're not going to believe in all these other gods, just one god, the sun god, Aten. So when he does this, we see a shift in the art for this period. It's very short-lived, but there is definitely a shift. You're going to see very curvy figures. You can see that in the image on slide 31. You're going to see bodies that are very effeminate, so even the men have effeminate shapes. You will see long faces, very big lips, heavy eyes, and bodies that are a little misshapen. So take a look at slide 32, and you're going to see a portrait of Akhenaten, and you will see all these things that I just said to you in this one portrait. Now here's the deal. We don't really know if this is a stylistic choice because it's just a stylistic choice, or is it because that's what Akhenaten really looked like? Did he have a really elongated face and an effeminate body and full lips and heavy eyes? It's possible. If you go back to slide 31 and you zoom in, you will see that it is a picture of him on the left and his wife on the right. And his wife is Nefertiti, maybe you've heard of her, and their two children. Do you notice that the children have very egg-shaped heads? Okay, this is where the conspiracy theorists would come in and say that they were aliens, okay, and that they built the pyramids, right? But we're not really sure if this was a stylistic choice to make them seem like they had more wisdom, a bigger head, more wisdom, or if there was some type of issue with inbreeding and genetics and that the children really did have elongated heads. So if we keep going on slide 33, you'll see a bust of his wife, Nefertiti. And this is probably one of the most famous sculptures in Egyptian history. It's a very famous bust. It's a lot of research has been done on this. So she was the mother of a very famous ruler, Tutankhamun. And we're going to talk about Tutankhamun in a moment. But I didn't want to show you on the left, I have a woman named Ty. And Ty is Akhenaten, our ruler's mother. Do you notice how her head looks? And then if you go back to slide 32, you see that her son has a very different appearance. So I don't know what her husband looked like. I don't know if these are genetic. We don't have all the answers. But I did want to show you what his mother looked like in comparison to him. And then, of course, his wife is Nefertiti, who is known as being one of the most beautiful rulers of ancient Egypt. So Nefertiti and Akhenaten have a son named Tutankhamun, King Tut. So Akhenaten dies, and after he dies, everything is reversed. We're going back to that normal system that's been in place for thousands of years with multiple gods. King Tut takes over, I think, around the age of 14, which is insane. So he's a very young king when his dad dies, and so his mother helps him rule. Now, King Tut's tomb was found in 1922 by Howard Carter. And we know that Tut died around the age of 18. And we think he ruled for a decade, so I mean, that means eight. You're going to find conflicting information on that. So he was Akhenaten's son. And there are three coffins that we found. And of course, I've shown you the innermost coffin, the most elaborate, the most famous, the gold coffin. This is gold, and then there's turquoise and lapis lazuli. And this is a portrait mask, which means it would look very much like him as a person. He's got the false beard. He has a headdress. He has the staffs. It's very regal. So King Tut, there's a lot of mystery around him. We think that there's evidence that he may have fallen and hurt himself due to a genetic condition with brittle bones. Some people claim that it was a conspiracy, which you can imagine if they were older and supposedly wiser men who have power in Egypt, and you see an 18-year-old ruling the kingdom, that maybe there are some ulterior motives there to hurt the king. But he did die very young, and we assume in some kind of, I'm going to say, some suspicious manner. There are plenty of documentaries out there for you guys to watch if you're interested on King Tut. And then the last thing I want to show you on slide 35, and I will wrap up after this, is just that after the new kingdom, Egypt's power declines and the Nile comes under the control of foreigners. That includes some kings from Nubia and then Alexander the Great and his Greek successors. And finally, in 30 BCE, Egypt becomes part of the Roman Empire. And the traditional forms of Egyptian art live on for a long time, even under foreign rule. For example, this is a portrait of the pharaoh as a sphinx from much later. You can tell that it's a more updated version compared to the one we looked at a few slides back into 30 BCE. So even though they do get taken over by foreign powers, their cultural identity remains. All right, and we're going to stop there, and I will catch up with you guys on chapter 4.